great. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Cycles of Change radio program here on July 26, 2012. I'm your host, David Katzmeyer, coming to you as I do every Thursday night at 8 p.m. New York time, 5 p.m. Pacific time. We have a very interesting program tonight. We're privileged to have Walter Cruttenden of the Binary Research Institute, who's going to come and tell us about a fascinating theory that our star may not be alone. The sun that we see every day may be part of a binary star system. In fact, astronomers tell us that most systems are binary stars. Some are solo, most are binaries, ours may be. But if we are, then the other star is a dwarf star that visits us in elliptical orbit over great periods of time. So we don't see it. It may be a star we recognize but don't know is coming back in for an orbit. It may be a dark dwarf that we don't see until it's very close. Fascinating theory that you can find out about at the Binary Research Institute at binaryresearchinstitute.org. So this is a particularly hitting home cycle, literally, because this is our backyard. It's our galaxy. The Binary Research Institute was formed in 2001 to support and fund research regarding the hypothesis that the sun is part of a binary star system. It is the goal of the Binary Research Institute to present evidence for this theory and to show that the motion of the sun is along a binary orbital path. This observation can cause and better explain the precessional motion that we find in the lunar, solar, and Earth wobbles. The Binary Research Institute is dedicated to the exploration of theories that seek to expand our understanding of celestial motion in our own solar system and in the Earth over great periods of time. The founder is Walter Cruttenden. He's an amateur astronomer, an archaeoastronomer, and he's here to tell us a little bit about this fascinating theory. So let's bring Walter on to join us. Walter, are you there?
I sure am, David. Great to be on the show.
Oh, wonderful to have you here. Walter, would you please tell us a little bit about the Institute and the basis of the binary star theory?
Gladly. The Binary Research Institute is located here in Newport Beach, California, and it's where we work to explore the cause and consequences of solar system motion. It's just a small handful of us that are sort of fascinated with this topic, and we do a lot of research mostly through the internet and through studying papers and some transit readings to try to, you know, get the data we need to figure out exactly what's going on here.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. And it appears that the evidence is leaning more and more towards that if we fine-tune the observations of the precession of the equinoxes, you know, wobbles in the axis of the Earth, which we can fine-tune over great periods of time, giving us the zodiac, small periods of time, such as the Chandler's wobble of only 7 years, a sub-wobble in it, and on, we're finding better tools and better means to measure these things. And as we do, it's looking like we're getting a little more fine-tuned on what we can observe. And your research is helping to explain a little bit of the questions that have been coming up.
Yes, it is. And, you know, I was really looking forward to be on your show because you approach this subject from a cycle standpoint. And, you know, some of the most obvious cycles and most exact cycles really are celestial driven. You know, the first one being the Earth spinning on its axis, obviously causing day and night, and our bodies are adapted to, you know, go into a subconscious state when we're away from light for long periods of time, called sleep, and go back into a waking state when the light comes again. And so that one has profound effects on our consciousness that we're hardly even aware of because it just happens so often. And, of course, the second major celestial cycle that we're aware of, this Earth going around the sun once a year, causes the cycle of the seasons and has, again, huge implications. It causes, you know, millions of life forms to spring out of the ground, bloom and decay, and other things to, you know, come out of hibernation or spawn or migrate in mass. And then everything sort of works the opposite when the light from the sun is waning. And so that explains a lot of things that go on in nature. And what this third cycle, I think, helps us to understand is on a much longer scale. And this is something that the ancients hinted at. There's over 30 different ancient cultures that spoke of a long-lost golden age and the cycle of the ages. You know, the Greeks called it the Great Year.
Yes.
And broke it into the, you know, iron, bronze, silver, and golden ages. And the Indians had a different name for it and also broke it into different periods. But we, in the modern era, we've sort of forgotten it and just assume that it's myth and folklore. And so the purpose of the Institute here is if we can really understand this cycle and see the scientific basis behind it, then really our whole view of history begins to change. And instead of sort of denigrating, you know, ancients as, hey, if they came before us, they must be more primitive, we start to appreciate the ancient wisdom and can incorporate some of it back into our lives. So that's what the research is all about.
That's so well said, Walter. You know, we've come so far in observing the physical evidence of the world and indeed part of the universe around us that we are perhaps catching up with the past. Before, you mentioned the ancient Greeks, they talked about the four great ages, and that perhaps came from Sanskrit, which talked about the yugas, the four yugas, which are basically the same thing over greater periods of time. And so how can someone speak of ages that are so much greater than a single lifetime? It's because they were observing the patterns, observing the cycles. And we tended to dismiss this as we moved into a more rational thought of looking at everything on a linear basis. But now that we're getting a little bit more into the evidence that we can see with our telescopes and our microscopes, we're realizing that there really is a cyclical pattern and the ancients may have been right. And I think, Walter, you're showing us some of the details of just how they were and taking it even further.
Yeah, it's a fun topic, and you make a very good point about our perspective. I often say that we're kind of like the mayfly. You know, mayfly is this bug that just lives for one day during a year, and if it happens to be born on a, you know, an overcast, windless day, it thinks that that's how all life is, all eternity is, and, you know, it never knows the joy of sunshine or riding on a breeze or anything like that. And so, yeah, we're in this fairly materialistic phase where we've come out of the Dark Ages. We're getting very clever at our technology, but we assume that, you know, life isn't a whole lot different than our myopic point of view, and that these tales about higher ages and amazing things that just can't be true. And I think it's really us that are, you know, we just don't have enough perspective yet to realize what's going on here. And these myths are just fascinating the way they allude to some of the higher ages.
You know, Mark Twain said that when he was 13 years old, that his father was just about the dumbest fella he had seen. But by the time he turned 20 years old, he was amazed at how much his father had learned in just 7 years. Well, how do we stand in history? There's an old saying, it takes one to know one. And as we are beginning to look at things greater and outside of ourselves and start to realize that there is a divine pattern in everything, and in fact, discern some of what the patterns are, we have a newfound appreciation for what the ancients may have known. So, Walter, could you tell me a little bit about the binary star theory? What might be the case of our sun? Does it have a sister?
So, yes, this is the sort of the main hypothesis that's operating behind this very long cycle of the ages. So just as the sun causes the day and night and the Earth revolution causes the cycle of the seasons, it's hypothesized that our sun moves around another star in a very long period of time, roughly 24,000 years. Mm-hmm. And during that period of time, he'd go from, you know, one dark age back to a dark age again, or one golden age back to a golden age again. And when I first read about this, I actually read about it in a book that was published back in the late 1800s. And the author that wrote about it, Swami Sri Yukteswar.
Yes.
Yeah, great guy. He was the guru of Paramahansa Yogananda, who wrote that famous book, Autobiography of a Yogi.
Yes.
Well, he says in there that, you know, according to Oriental astronomy, our sun takes another star and goes around it in about 24,000 years. And and at the time he said it, it was not very well known that most stars were in binary systems. But, of course, over the last 50 years or so, most astronomers have realized that, wow, if you look closely, a lot of these stellar systems are binary or trinary or multiple star systems. And the latest figure on the NASA Chandra website says that it's believed that up to 80% of all stars might be in binary or multiple star systems, because they're now finding so many of these brown dwarfs and very difficult to see stars out there.
Well, that,
so
yeah.
It really, you know, it begs the question, if stars have partners this often, you know, why wouldn't our own sun have a partner?
It stands to reason. Well, if our sun has a partner, does that mean that our sun is going to be moving in a little bit of a wobble that we can't see on the short term? Or are the stars moving equally around each other? Or does one of them stay a little bit more centered while the other one goes off on a tangent and comes back
to us? You're getting to the crux of the matter here. You know, we have a very strong scientific community nowadays. And so when I talk to most astronomers, they say, well, heck, if that's the case, we would have known it by now. And indeed, if you look up at the sun and look at the sun's position every year, say on the equinox, you will see that the sun moves across the sky at about 50 arc seconds per year, 50.3 actually. Mm-hmm. And at that rate, it would take this roughly 24 to 26,000 years to go completely around us. Now, when that when Copernicus first tried to explain that, he said the Earth must wobble, because Copernicus had just established that the sun was the center of the solar system and therefore could not move. Mm. And then when Newton came along, he said, okay, if the sun has a third motion, it not only spins on its axis and, I'm sorry, if the Earth has a third motion, it not only spins on its axis and goes around the sun, but it also wobbles, like Copernicus said, then it must be due to gravity. And so Newton put together this whole theory that the sun and the moon wobble the Earth's axis. And therefore, that explains why we see the sun go across the sky, because we're wobbling.
Okay.
And so it constrained any motion of the sun to zero. And even though Newton's equations have long been disproven, we still operate with that sort of mindset that the sun cannot be moving because the Earth itself is wobbling, and that's why we see the sun appear to move, but it's not a real motion. And what we've really been zeroing in on is mathematical models and a lot of other evidence that suggests, well, really, the Earth does not wobble that much. Yes, it has a little bit caused by the moon and tides and things like this, but it's only an arc second or two per year, whereas we see the sun go across the sky 50 arc seconds plus per year, and therefore the bulk of the sun's motion is real. The sun is really moving across the sky. In other words, it's moving somewhere, going around something.
Indeed, indeed. You know, when we think we see the answer to something, we stop looking. And wasn't that long ago we believed the Earth was flat, and then we realized that the sun is not going around us, we're going around the sun. And then how recently was it that we realized that Pluto is not even the largest object in the recently discovered Kuiper Belt? So
it was Mike Brown at Caltech who he's credited with the man that killed Pluto, because he found so many objects out there that were about that size, and even one that's been confirmed to be larger than Pluto.
Yeah.
And of course, we now have 8 planets instead of 9, but all these dwarfs. And some of these planets, too, the only way you can explain their unusual orbits, like Pluto, which is 17 degrees off plane, or Sedna, is if there is another large object out there that's perturbing them. And so, indeed, Mike Brown, one of the top astrophysicists in the world, is one of these fellows that's looking for either a 10th planet or a companion star to our sun. And so, finally, the scientific community is getting serious about this search.
Now, if there is a companion to our sun as a star out there, would we perhaps see it as a star and not recognize that it's moving towards us and away from us in a cyclical pattern? Or could it be a star that's very difficult to see because of its nature? There's dwarf stars, there's dark stars. What could explain why we haven't seen it so far?
Well, there's sort of two schools of thought that are emerging. And one is what you just mentioned, that it must be a dark star, like a brown dwarf, or maybe a red dwarf towards the galactic center where there's so much background noise it's a little hard to see things. Or, some planet-like mass that is cold and dark and very difficult to detect. And so there's some, that probably the majority of people are looking in that direction. And I think that's what Mike Brown is after, and Richard Mueller at up at Berkeley, and a couple others. But there's another school of thought that's becoming a little more prominent lately, and that is maybe things work a little different outside of the solar system than they do locally. Perhaps the solar system's moving faster than we expected, or gravity, maybe it's slightly modified. There's a theory called modified Newtonian dynamics in big space, and that might explain dark matter and things like this. And in that case, there's a few people that are saying it could well be a visible star, one of the close ones. And therefore, we would just have to watch it for a long enough period of time to sort of detect this. And, you know, it's not really something people have practiced, but there are a couple that are doing some brilliant research there. And if we have time, I'd love to tell you about one of those up in Canada.
Well, we're going to explore some of these things. It's an hour program. You're listening to the Cycles of Change radio show with Walter Cruttenden of the Binary Research Institute. Fascinating theory about our sun possibly being part of a double sun system. And such a concept along this line is not entirely unique. There have been other works about other bodies in our solar system that we really don't recognize and have recorded that might be influencing us. There's the work of Sitchin, who talked about the 12th planet. And there's also another theory that there may be a large asteroid, large planet or so, that is out in our solar system, which we now know is much larger than we once conceived, that possibly comes and visits us every 26 million years. And in the process of doing it, drags in with gravitational pull objects from the outer Kuiper Belt where Pluto is, and they come raining down in the inner planets of the solar system and might smack the Earth like possibly they did millions of years ago, and they wiped out the dinosaurs. there's theories like this. Now, I'm mentioning these two things only to show that the notion that there is more than we know and it's out there possibly orbiting our sun is not entirely far-fetched or unique.
Not at all. You know, we discovered that the Earth spins on its axis sort of since the Dark Ages, and we discovered that the Earth goes around the sun, and now I think we're very close to discovering that our sun is part of a binary system. But it could be that the whole system also moves through space in a much greater cycle, suggesting that what you mentioned, the 26 million year cycle, which some have talked about, or even larger, may have some basis in fact. But that one is so long, you know, we don't have any histories of it versus this 24,000 year one. I mean, that would be 12,000 years up, 12,000 years down. That we could have, you know, a good portion of recorded history, roughly the last 5,000 years. We should see some evidence of that cycle within the last 5,000 years. And indeed, if you look at most of the writings on this 24,000-year cycle, they say that the low point is, in other words, when we're the farthest from this companion star, takes place around 500 AD. Mm. And sure enough, if you look at sort of world civilizations, I mean, there's a lot of factors that affect civilizations, but there's one sort of micro trend going on, and that is virtually every great civilization is declining prior to the Dark Ages and, you know, falls apart in the Dark Ages. And then since that time, you know, one by one, the different nations are sort of climbing out of it and adopting new ideas and technology and things like this. And when you look into the details, you look at Mesopotamia. They had a knowledge of astronomy, advanced mathematics. They had great buildings and structures. They had underground sewers, indoor plumbing, amazing stuff. And by the time of the Dark Ages, they were nomads running around in tents.
Amazing.
Yeah, or look at Harappa, Mohenjo-Daro, the whole Indus Valley in India. Again, same thing. Indoor plumbing, amazing uniform building products, advanced you know, knowledge of engineering. And today they live in, well, today it's a little more modern, but just a few hundred years ago they were living in huts on top of this ruined site.
So history does not move in a linear fashion. It has its ups and downs. It has its tides.
It does seem to definitely have that. And even, you know, if you look at the Americas, I was just reading a new article that hit on the Maya culture, you know, was thought that they were flourishing around our Dark Ages. And now they're discovering that, no, the Maya were started much earlier and may have been at their height well before the Dark Ages, and they actually declined and then were totally wiped out sort of in the middle of the Dark Ages. And so it's consistent all over the world. And that's not to say, David, that there aren't other factors like, you know, weather and famine and political issues. But there seems to be a macro cause that underlies or serves as a backdrop to many of these other factors.
That sounds reasonable, that there may be external forces, and Shakespeare's observation that there are tides in the affairs of man. You pointed out about our daily cycle. They call this the circadian rhythms within us. It's not only the wake-sleep cycle, but so many biological things that can be measured, body temperatures and so forth, and the seasons of the years. Moving on. So why would there not be longer term cycles in civilizations going up and down? The whole advent of how we measure the great year, the zodiac, is based on the precession of the equinoxes from some 24 to 26,000 years. And many believe that these have behavioral changes on us. So, yeah, we are influenced, you know, and let's not forget the moon. Whether you believe in astrology or not, there's no denying that the lunar cycle of about 28 days has had an influence not only on women's menstrual cycles of about 28 days, But the observation of biorhythms shows that there is a 28-day emotional cycle in both men and women. We are influenced by the celestial bodies around us, are we not, Walter?
It seems to be the case. And again, I'm with you. I don't know much about astrology. And, you know, probably the science of astrology, you know, was really denigrated like everything else during the Dark Ages, and maybe it's very little understood now. But I do think that there are subtle influences that, you know, we're slowly beginning to discover. Heck, we didn't even, you know, rediscover magnetism and electricity and a lot of finer forces until we started to come out of the Renaissance here. So, I wouldn't doubt if there's other influences going on. But, you know, speaking of the zodiac, and they actually use points of measurement in the zodiac, you know, as the sun moves through the 12 signs, to explain phases within the great year, almost like we would use numbers on a clock to say, hey, you know, when it reaches this point, it's going to be dark out, or at this time, it's time to wake up, et cetera. And I love reading the Indian writings and some of the Greek writings, say by Hesiod and others, that talk about these periods. And the Greeks are a perfect example where they not only break it into the iron, bronze, silver, and golden age, but they say that the iron is sort of the age of man, when mankind only believes in, you know, that he's a physical being walking on a physical earth, and he has no knowledge of finer forces, et cetera, until then he comes to be the age of the hero, and you start to discover that life is much more than perceived to be on the surface. You know, we're made of molecules and atoms, and there's other things going on. There might be subtle influences that we're unaware of. And then, of course, the next two ages are supposed to be the age of the demigods and the age of the gods, which is pretty hard for us to relate to at this time, when they're above us and not below us. But the detail with which the ancient cultures in completely different parts of the globe talked about these cycles in such uniform ways that it really lends credence to the idea that this cycle must have been real for all these cultures to be saying the same thing.
Well, there's cycle synchronies, you know, as you mentioned, in different parts of the world, they'll be going up or down. I mean, do you have regional differences all the times? We see this in the currency exchange markets internationally on short term. But in the longer trends of civilization, there seem to be golden eras and dark ages. And could it be that we are actually acting out and giving evidence to the fact that there is a low point in the cycle, when at that time we turn away from the knowledge of the past and say, no, that isn't true? But we in fact do that when it's time for us to do so, because we're not as wise as we were.
Yeah, we not only turn away from it, but if you look what was going on in the, you know, the early parts of the Dark Ages and through the Dark Ages, they're pretty much destroying all the great ancient civilizations and knowledge, and, you know, burning books and just tearing things down. It's quite destructive, and I don't think we have the capacity to learn or understand very well. Yuktaswar even says that, you know, mankind uses very little of his brain in the lowest age, and whereas now we're, you know, we're a little smarter than we were in the Dark Ages. We're using more of our brain, and first it sort of manifests just as a more clever material technology. But I think it's increasingly manifesting as, you know, democracy and compassion and better health care, and, you know, we're getting connected as a world and can be finally aware of each other's problems and express concern. And you know, if you look at 500 years ago, every nation is on earth is at war with one another. Heck, every county is at war with one another.
Yes.
And yeah, things, there's still some wars on the planet. There's still some tough periods of time, but we've come a long way, baby, in, you know, just a few hundred years.
Well, and we're going to keep on rising, because this is a long term ascent, if it's true. And Sri Yukteswar, who wrote The Holy Science, I'm familiar with that book. I happen to have read it some years ago. It's fascinating that he talked about a 24,000-year cycle. And here it is, you know, what is it, more than a century later since that book was written, that we're actually starting to see some evidence that suggests that is true. And if we are part of a binary solar system, then we are part of the majority. Most stars are part of a binary system. So maybe Yukteswar was right. The evidence is pointing in that direction, and we're starting to understand the invisible a little more.
Yeah. And it literally rewrites history, if he's correct, in that, you know, coming out of the Dark Ages, where you've destroyed everything that came before and don't have capacity, you know, to really understand anthropology and archaeology and things very well, we came up with theories for why we're advancing, and we saw, you know, adaptation of the species, which is clearly real and occurs, Darwin's work, but we then applied that to social sciences and said, well, that must be what's happening here. And of course, yes, we are evolving from the Dark Ages, but why were we sort of devolving going into the Dark Ages? And so it kind of gives us a different way to look at our histories, and I think better understand who we are and you know, where we came from and why we had all these great civilizations around the globe and why so many of them were destroyed and why we seem to be getting knowledge back once again.
You may be answering more questions than just astronomy, and it's wonderful to hear somebody with a scientific mind such as yours, Walter, to say these things. I was born in the 1950s when still at that time there was such a conflict. Everybody talked about the conflict between science and religion. And yet, since then, as we moved away from Newtonian, Cartesian thought and philosophy and more into quantum physics and so forth, these differences are becoming resolved. We're realizing that as we look at the physical evidence of the universe, it's showing that so much of what the ancients talked about is true. So again, it's a newfound appreciation, and you start out looking at astronomical cycles and you correlate it with the cycles of our own behavior. So we're learning about many fields at one time as all spokes lead to the center of the wheel, aren't we, Walter?
Yeah, that's a very good point, that at first our knowledge seemed to be just taking us in a material direction as we're just coming out of the Dark Ages. But now our knowledge is growing so fast, and as we penetrate you know, the whole sort of quantum area, if you will, it almost is getting mystical again, isn't it? We're learning that, hey, things just don't even seem to make logical sense at this very small level, or at the very large level, if you look the way the universe is built. And we need some of these sort of ancient theories or mythologies to try to explain it.
Imagine the sound of one hand clapping. Well, why would the Taoists say things that deliberately make no sense to the rational mind? I've heard it explained that it is an attempt to trick the mind against tricks, because all the world is illusion, or Maya, as they say in Sanskrit. They were attempting to show that while our rational mind can construct models that seem to be quite workable for us on certain levels, to really understand beyond that, we're going to have to leap beyond logic and realize that there are things that would confound the models with which we became familiar. And we're doing this more now as we resolve the difference between science and religion, start to look a little bit more and find out that, you know, our models of the atom, the way we used to think they were, aren't quite true now. They describe particles as having a tendency to exist at some times in this area at that way, unless we look at them, then they change. Okay. But fortunately, the things that you're explaining to us are something that we certainly can understand. And as we look with the Hubble telescope and new telescopes that are going to go out and be four times more powerful, we're starting to see that there are norms out there that we might ascribe to our own solar system now that we know a little bit more of what to look for. You've documented a lot of the research on your site at binaryresearchinstitute.org. You have, in fact, a link titled Evidence, where you can go in there and see some of the solid premises of the things that you're talking about. And then from there, you can go on to the calculations link and find out a little bit more about this. So, Walter, you're really doing a service for us all to lay this out. Why do you feel it's important that you do this work that you labor at so much to help us understand these things about the world around us?
Well, I came at it from sort of a history point of view. I was fascinated by history when I was a child, and my mom gave me all these books on, you know, very ancient civilizations, and I saw that they had many advances and that so many of them went away during the Dark Ages. And when I got into school, they taught us that, well, everything's pretty much linear. We're evolving, and therefore anything that came before us must be more primitive. And I just had a big disconnect in my mind that it just didn't make sense. And so, you know, I shoved it down and went on with my career and business, which was mostly, you know, technology research and that sort of thing. And but I kept reading history books. And then when I started reading more that sort of mentioned a cycle and linked it to a real verifiable phenomena, you know, a celestial cause, just all the light bulbs started to go off.
Indeed.
And, you know, for me, it's a passion. I've been working at it 10 years since, and I love it because I think it's the best way to explain so much phenomena out there. Plus, it's hopeful, you know. It's if these true stories are true about how people lived in the higher ages, then you know, I can hardly wait till we get back there.
Well,
like you said the word.
Well, getting there is all the fun because, you know, for every day there is a night, and you know, there's balance in the universe. There really is yin and yang, and they say that the Tao is one yin and one yang. But you really have a vision, and you were sparked by this. It's interesting to hear you say how you came into it.
And it's not just me either, David. I mean, there's other people that are talking about this. I'm sure you've talked to some on your show, but we have this conference every year. This is going to be our eighth annual. It's called the Conference on Precession and Ancient Knowledge, where we'll have, you know, archaeologists, anthropologists. We've got a geologist this year, Dr. Robert Schock, who's been investigating Göbekli Tepe, Turkey, one of the oldest civilizations on Earth. And more of these guys are showing up at our conference and embracing the idea that the cycle of the ages is real and that there must be a deeper explanation for why we had so much knowledge long, long ago, and then it seemed to just be lost everywhere. So I don't know if any of your listeners are fascinated by this as much as I am, but...
You're on Cycles Radio, baby. Are they interested in this? When does this conference take place?
It's October 5th to 7th at the Rancho Mirage Westin Resort. And anybody that wants information can just go to cpaconline.com. That's cpaconline.com. And it stands for Conference on Precession and Ancient Knowledge.
Wow, I'm going to be checking that out. I'll tell you what, that's right up my alley, and it relates to so many other fields, and you're connecting it with physical evidence as well, and as well there should be. That which is, you know, they say from the unmanifest comes the manifest, and if there's something true on the abstract level, then usually there is a correlation with something physical. If we don't see it, it's just because we haven't discovered it yet. Once we learn more, we usually find they coincide.
It's so true. And Hey, David, you know, if you're interested, I'm happy to get you in as my guest, and I'll even, you know, offer your listeners a couple free tickets if you want to have some giveaway program or something like that. Just, I'm actually more passionate that people understand the science behind this whole thing than I am about making money on the thing. But it's just a great fun thing.
Well, you heard it here on Cycles Radio. This is a fascinating conference that's going to be coming up. If I am there, we'll certainly have to do a show from there about what's going on, because we are learning that, well, you know, it's a bit of arrogance of modern thinking to believe that any civilization that existed before us would have to be more primitive and less learned than we are, because we are the pinnacle of civilization. We're the most developed, the most wise, the smartest, the best in everything that has ever lived. And the irony, when we say that, we are not accounting for cycles, which are replete through, well, everything. So, you know, it's a divine comedy. Dostoevsky said that God is a comedian playing before an audience that's afraid to laugh.
It's so true, yeah.
But you're shedding light.
Yeah, you know, there's another school of thought on what our companion might be. I mentioned that besides the dark star theory, there's the possibility that it's a very visible star. And if you look at some of these ancient civilizations, there's many that did talk about one star in particular. And it happens to be the brightest star in the sky that we, you know, call Sirius today. But to the Egyptians, they said that this star, they called it Isis, and said that she brought life and then took it away. So she sort of has a cyclical influence on us. And the Shinto of ancient Japan actually called it our second sun, and they align their temples to it. And you can still see some of the old Shinto temples that are aligned to southwest there. And
my goodness.
Yeah, and so there's some fellows in Canada that have done some amazing research on studying Sirius. They've taken transit readings for just about 20 years, and they found that there seems to be virtually no precession relative to this one star. I mean, what we think is Earth wobble doesn't seem to happen when you measure it relative to this star. And other scholars have noticed that Sirius seems to move along with the sun through the sky. And this is exactly the type of phenomena you would expect if we were gravitationally bound to it. And so it's interesting to see how some of these very ancient historical tidbits just might help us, you know, find out what modern astronomy is struggling today with, which is, you know, if the sun does have a companion, which star is it?
Well, it certainly seems to be coming together, and I think it's going to be very intriguing to people. I see we have a caller here who's patiently been waiting. Let's click them through and field a question. Would that be all right, Walter?
Absolutely.
Let me field a question. Area code 631. Caller.
Hello, how are you doing? My name is Sydney.
Hi, Sydney.
And I'm from New York.
Yes.
How are you doing? When I saw the show, it was amazing because I've been researching this since about 2005 when I spoke with Andy Lloyd in London about his Dark Star Theory book. But something throughout my research that kind of has me puzzled is in the stella of Naram-Sin. Are you familiar with that?
Hello? Where is that stella, Sydney?
The stella is from it's from the Mesopotamian area of what looks to be like a tall being with a helmet with horns, and it's supposed to be talking about the conqueror of the mountain people, and above the mountain in the carving is two stars in the sky. And I noticed in a lot of archaeology books they cut off the two skies, the two stars. It looks like just a mountain with what appears to be a being much bigger than the mountain people that supposedly looks conquered. But as I studied that that freeze, I noticed it's broken on top of the two stars, and it looks like it actually has a third star beginning. You know, so I guess if it was in full, it had me really thinking, because I've been on, you know, saying, okay, the binary star theory definitely makes sense. But then when I noticed that, I said, wait a second. Sorry about that. There's a little lightning over here. It had me puzzled, because I'm saying, you know, that piece of evidence, the stella of Narim, it really, that's the only piece that I've found, basically, that has two stars in it and is supposed to be like a Sumerian, Mesopotamian, Assyrian artifact that is, I'd say they date to about 6,000 years old.
Yeah, boy, that's a fascinating topic, the whole Mesopotamian culture. One of my partners that helps me on this, Jason Martell, that's his particular area of study, so I'm sure he's familiar with it. You might know him. He goes on Ancient Aliens a lot. But, I will ask him about that. But to just briefly touch on the three-star idea, so in many of these writings, they talk about there's our sun and there's its partner star, and they go around each other like any other ordinary binary system. But what actually causes the waxing and waning of the higher and lower ages is that as we go around, it takes us closer to and farther from a third point. And the third point is, you know, to be speculated upon. The Hindu writings call it Vishnu Nabhi. But some say that it might be the Pleiades. And there's a beautiful a saying in the Old Testament in the book of Job. It says, "Canst thou bind the sweet influence of the Pleiades or loose the bands of Orion?" And I think it's a rhetorical question where, you know, people are saying, hey, can't we just stay in the higher ages, you know, bound close to the Pleiades here? And, of course, the answer is, well, not any more than you can break apart the bands, the stars in Orion's band. You know, these things are celestial cycles, and they just happen. But those three stellar points, our sun, its companion, and then this Vishnu Nabhi, seems to be part of this ancient iconography.
That's very interesting. Very. I never thought of the Sirius connection with that. I've studied the Dogon tribe. But Sirius, yes, it's the brightest star. It, if you track it from one point to the other point of our horizons, it takes exactly one solar Earth year to traverse the whole sky. So that's another I don't know if I should say weird coincidence, you know, because there's really not coincidences. And then,
but you're right. It seems to track the motion of the sun much more than other stars out there, and more and more people are doing research into that, and it's a good point.
Really, yeah. The show is great, and thank you so much for taking my call.
Well, thank you for checking in, and you brought in some very interesting points, and we'll probably look in that direction about the stella. Another corroborating factor brought in from one of our listings. Thank you so much for that. You know, we mentioned the Dogon, Walter. Do they not have a dance that is done some every 60 years that's supposed to actually mimic the binary star system that they speak of? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I do know a little bit about it because one of our regular speakers at CPAC, the Conference on Procession and Ancient Knowledge, has been Laird Scranton. And he has written three books on the Dogon and their language and their mythology. And, he mentioned that they are aware of Sirius B, this little tiny star that goes around Sirius A.
Yes.
And it's a big controversy out there. You might have read it in some of the books that they supposedly had knowledge of this before Western mankind knew of this.
Yes.
Because it wasn't discovered until the late 1800s. And so Carl Sagan even stepped in on this topic in the 60s and early 70s. And he said, well, if the Dogon did learn it, they must have learned it from a modern scientist that was passing through. But if you look at the Dogon culture, they keep masks on their walls of, you know, and each mask represents a generation. And I think it goes back like 70 masks or something like that.
Yes.
They say that this is part of their folklore that goes back to the beginning of the masks. And you're right, there's this 50-year cycle of Sirius B going around Sirius A.
Yes.
And it seems to have an effect on our system.
And one of those stars is supposedly a dark star, so it could be virtually invisible to someone maybe living on a planet in that solar system. They wouldn't necessarily recognize that there was two stars if that were true.
Could well be. And, you know, another fascinating thought in all this is I've been reading a lot of what the old scholars had said about some of the Mesopotamian writings. And this word Nibiru is actually the word that Spicer and Pegler and other guys out there used to refer to the star Sirius, because they said it means brightest object in the sky. And although apparently when Sitchin interpreted that, because Nibiru hadn't been attached to any specific object in the Mesopotamian language, they just used it to refer to brightest object in the sky, and we've assumed that it's Sirius. He assumed that it was some object that then came close into our planetary system and therefore would be the brightest object. But what if it's just truly is, you know, just the brightest star, and it's the one we see every night when we look up there?
Well, we have to consider all possibilities, but that's what leads to understanding that we might be part of a binary system instead of just a single solar system, as we once thought. We do that by considering all theories. And when you look at some of the historic observations that you're telling us about, now our caller from New York City pointed out that there are observations that seem to be supporting some of the things that we are seeing now. So as we start developing further out in the space, what we're going to be able to see in the next 30 years with new probes and so forth, it's going to be absolutely fascinating, and it's going to break apart some of the old schools of thought. We never realized there were so many moons around Jupiter. We didn't know there was volcanic activity on the moons, or that there was a moon that's completely covered with ice with probably a 60-mile deep ocean throughout the entire planet. All of these things are just wondrous to us.
Yeah, so, now that we're finding that there's water on other planets and moons, we might just well find that there's life there too. I'm not saying that anyone knows that for sure or that I'm sure, but it wouldn't surprise me if that revelation was made sometime in the next 10 or 20 years.
It would not be surprising. And if any other guests have a question, you can call in at area code 347-884-9593. That's 347-884-9593. Well, we're learning to differentiate beyond our familiar comfort zones. As we learn more about the universe, we learn more about time, and we learn about our own observations of that. So your website has been developed, and I see you have papers and articles on it as well. You've got some wonderful illustrations on here that make it really plain and simple. And I think that's a sign of understanding. What you're talking about is that you can explain it in a way that's intelligible to the rest of us.
Well, thanks. And just to make it even more intelligible, I've actually just wrote my first children's book on the topic. It's called The Great Year Adventures with Tommy the Time Traveling Turtle. And we basically take this concept of a cycle of the ages and what causes it, the binary motion, and try to say it in really explain it in simple terms. And my illustrator here came up with this great character, and you know, we really had fun doing it. And I really truly hope that the next generation will just be a little bit more open-minded to these things than we are, and that's one of the reasons for doing a children's book.
Well, I love the concept of a turtle. I went to a play at Rockefeller Center, I think it was, with Tom Stoppard, the great playwright from England, was previewing a play, and I forget the name of it, but it was wonderful. It was set in modern times, and it would go back into the 19th century, and then it would jump back and forth, but he had this wonderful thread of continuity. But one of the ways that he would illustrate what time you're in, despite the costumes, was he had a turtle. And when you were in the 19th century, you had this little turtle on the stage. But when you were in the modern time, there was this tortoise, because the thing had grown up to be so big. So after the play, I went out back. There he was standing alone out back waiting to catch a cab. And it was a quiet street. And I walked up to him, introduced myself. I told him I loved the play. And I said, you know, Mr. Stoppard, I believe I saw what was behind that which is behind what you were writing in the story. And really what you were telling us about was the cycles of time. And he just looked at me with widened eyes. And we stood there talking for a while. He asked me if I wanted to share a cab with him, and we went uptown. And that hit a note, because I think if we realize that there's patterns replete through everything, and we see it in messages, we see it in unconscious writings, and we can really tell the story when we understand it. So I'm glad you're putting it together in a children's book.
Yeah, it was fun. And quite frankly, I learned some things myself, you know, just trying to break the story down here. The turtle happens to be a symbol of Vishnu, which is carries time on its back, you know, and carries the entire cosmos. And also this cycle of the zodiac, you know, I'd always wondered where the 24-hour system of time came, with 12 hours of a.m. increasing light and 12 hours of p.m. sort of decreasing light. And if you read sort of the modern scholars on it, the farthest back we can trace it is to somewhere in Egypt or Mesopotamia. But, yes, of course, we don't know how they came up with it. It turns out it's a perfect microcosm of the great year, which is, you know, not 24 hours, but 24,000 years.
Mm.
And there's 12,000 years of ascending, just as we have 12 hours of a.m. increasing light and 12,000 years descending. And sure enough, we're all carrying around on our wristwatches just this little tiny microcosm, this ancient wisdom of, you know.
And that's fascinating. Yes, yeah. Because when you go back in the Babylonian numerical system, which has a base 12 and a base 60 in it, and the ancient Chaldeans, and we have 12 hours and 12 parts of the zodiac, that I understood as perhaps, you know, part of the great year. But I never understood why, well, then if 12 is the thing, what's with the 24? And you just put something into place here, the 24,000 year of our binary star system, which has been seen, as we know from Sri Yukteswar in the 19th century.
Yes. Matter of fact, one of our proofs, it's in the technical paper, but it has to do with the rate that the sun moves across the sky. So at the current rate, 50.3 arc seconds, it would take like 25,770 years. But we noticed, if you go back in the history books, the rate before that was 50.2, the rate before that was 50.1, and that's when the light bulb went off, and we said, well, heck, the rate of the sun moving across the sky has to increase and decrease just like any body in orbit around any other body. It must follow Kepler's laws. As it gets closer to the other object, it speeds up. As it gets farther away, it slows down. And so we did a mathematical model and found that we can better predict changes in the current precession rate and by using this simple model of a speeding up and slowing down a body in an orbit, in a 24,000-year orbit with a low point about 1,500 years ago, than any other modern method of predicting the changes in the rate of precession today.
That's brilliant. You know, Kepler said that orbiting bodies will sweep equal areas in equal time. In short, when you have an elliptical orbit, that which is orbiting will move faster when it's closer to the body it orbits than it does move when it's out further away. So that's the only thing that would explain the change in the speed that we see in the sun. I think the answers are clear for us. We're here in the final minute of the Cycles of Change radio, talking with Walter Cruttenden of the Binary Research Institute. some fascinating observations of the celestial bodies around us and the possibility, or I would advocate the probability, that we're living in a binary star system. Find out more about Walter's work at BinaryResearchInstitute.org. And Walter, thank you so much for being part of this program this evening.
Thank you, David.
Marvelous. Let us contemplate a little bit more about the world around us and get out of old familiar norms. The world is not flat. The sun's not going around us. And we're not the greatest thing that's ever been created. But we're all part of the process that is wonderful. We're all cells of a great organism, and we're in part of a great cyclical universe. Thank you for joining us. I'm David Katzmar, your host on The Cycles of Change.
David. David, you still there?
Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah, I can.
Oh, really? Oh, wow, yeah. That's great. We can still talk. I never did this before. That's cool.
Okay, I just had to stay on to say, man, I love your consciousness. You are a cool guy, and, man, I could have talked for hours with you.
Well, we're just going to have to do this again, I'll tell you. And I didn't realize that you had gone into the social history, that you had gone into the mystical observations that have been made through time, and then you've gone into the ancient wisdom of the East. And that's where it's all at. It really does coincide.
Yeah, it's fun. So anyway, I've got all these speakers and authors and scientists that I work with on this subject, and if you're ever looking for other people to have on your show, I'll just send them your way, okay?
Oh, we have to talk. Okay, we'll do that. We'll do that. Okay, I don't think we're recording now, but but in any case, I do want to talk to you about that, Walter, because a recommendation from you is one I would take quite seriously for Cycles Radio. I think you were marvelous, and I think this is going to be a good program for people to hear. Hey, spread the word.
On
your site, post it, send out emails, whatever you do, social networks, get the word out there. It's going to be part of the permanent archive here, and I hope we get many listens, Walter. I'm sure we'll talk again.
Okay, buddy. Thanks a lot. Take care. Bye.
Yes, sir.